From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here at Brian Kilmeade Show. Brian Bernberg is going to be here at the bottom of the hour. I really want him to unwind why Wall Street is stepping up for the former president. Shocking. A lot of these people said they wouldn't. Also, I want to take a look at what the message is to big money makers when you go after somebody's wealth because you don't like their politics. That's how I view it. Brian Bernberg from FBN will be here. And we'll also take your calls, 1-866-408-7669. Well, a lot is going on, so let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
We don't know if Hunter Biden is actually going to be found guilty. I think he will. We don't know, even if he's found guilty, whether he will go get a real prison sentence. Joe Biden will pardon his son to spare him a prison sentence after the election, one way or the other.
Of course, Jonah Goldberg is right. Hunter trial. The jury deliberations continue today in Wilmington. We'll review the slam dunk gun case in favor of prosecution, but the home field could give the edge to the defense. I'll explain.
Number two.
Some of the most progressive and left parts of the Democratic Party are standing for the kind of side that have kinds of organizations like Hamas. And I never saw that on the bingo card. But
yeah, it's crazy. That Senator Fetterman bringing it up making so much sense. A cease peace deal. I hope Israel walks away from it as a frustrated Blinken and Biden may decide to talk directly with Hamas about Americans being held hostage. Really? Now we talk to terrorists? Really? We're changing policies again under these guys? I have the latest.
Number one.
But let's be clear. They're all ghosts in new garments trying to take us back. Taking away your freedoms, making it harder for black people to vote.
You
or have your vote counted.
Just nuts. So irresponsible for a candidate, let alone a sitting president. 2024, money and support flowing in from most unlikely sources, Wall Street and Silicon Valley for Donald Trump. As Joe Biden uses a Juneteenth concert to label Trump and all Republicans a racist, mysteriously freezing McConnell style during the concert. I hope he's not having neurological problems, but he literally was a statue. I mean, I'm somebody who doesn't pride myself on my dancing. I know I quote Brett Eldridge, who says, I never met a dance floor that did me any good, but I've never frozen in time. For his sake, I hope he's okay. But what he said is not okay. He talks about going back in time. Let me just remind this president, because he shouldn't need to be reminded, because his best friend was the former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, Senator Byrd, who eulogized him and his death. But if you want to go back in time, the Democrats were the ones who fought the Civil War, who gave us the Ku Klux Klan, who gave us separate but equal, who gave us separate water fountains and separate bathrooms for blacks and whites, and gave us Jim Crow. That's what the Democrats. So if you want to go back in time, I don't think you're going to like that walk through the past. But again, totally irresponsible. If you want to get the black vote, how about this? I will level the playing field. So I will make sure that everybody has an equal shot at everything. Equal shot, not equal outcomes. But you don't pander to people and say, I know you're going to need extra help because white people are extra bad and Republicans are the worst. Cut one.
It was about a statement of faith. It was testimony of a testament to the resilience of generations of black Americans who kept their eyes set on the nation's North Star. That North Star was the idea that we're all created equal, in the image of God, and deserve to be treated equally throughout our lives. While we've never lived up to it, we've never fully walked away from it either.
By the way, if I was talking like that, they would give me a breathalyzer. He does sound drunk. I know he doesn't drink, but he does sound drunk. And by the way, the testimony of a testament, oh, good luck with that. I'm sure that wasn't in the prompter. But his message is so disturbing. It's as if it's George Wallace, 1972. Or running against George Wallace. Cut two.
But let's be clear. They're all ghosts in new garments trying to take us back. Well, there are. Taking away your freedoms, making it harder for black people to vote. Or have your vote counted. Closing doors of opportunity. Attacking the values of diversity, equity, and inclusion. If you can believe it, banning books about black experience in America. Trying to erase and rewrite history. Our history is not just about the past. It's about our present and our future.
All right. Number one, he's not banning books about slavery and history. They want appropriate books at appropriate ages. Little Johnny, at 8 years old, doesn't need to know about transgenderism. Got it? You're born a boy or born a girl. Don't confuse the kids. Kids are confused. Enough. That's what he was saying, and he's talking about Ron DeSantis in Florida and some other districts who want to get a hold of what's in the libraries. Appropriate books for appropriate ages is not book banning. Please don't fall for that. Number two is Donald Trump. You want to vote for him or not vote for him? Not a racist. Never has been one. Do you think Byron Donalds? Do you think Senator Tim Scott? Do you think Harold Ford? Do you think other people would hang Wesley Hunt, Congressman Wesley Hunt? Do you think Alan West, do you think they would give the time of day to somebody they thought was a racist, running on racist policies? But go ahead. You think like that. I know you don't. Support for Joe Biden among black voters was at 79% in 2020. It's now down 72%, which means 18% get to Trump. Now, most polls, Trump is up 24%. That would be devastating to the future of the Republican, the Democratic Party. Devastating. But it tells you where they're at. They're desperate. Remember, Jim Crow 2.0, that's what they told her the Georgia voting rules were. It wasn't anything. To tell somebody to have an ID is not anti-black. In fact, it's insulting to think black people don't have IDs. Do they get on planes? Do they go into buildings? Do they work for Amazon? Do they deliver anything? Do they work for UPS? Do they work for an executive, a Wall Street firm? You can't get anywhere without ID. Nobody, you're not kissing up to any group. Black group by saying, well, you should be able to vote whether you have ID or not. People want their votes to count. They don't want it swamped by people voting illegally, which brings you to the conclusion. If you watch President overseas, you see him come back to Wilmington. Now he's going to fly back to the G7 while blowing off a peace summit with Ukraine that Zelensky asked him not to. But he's got to go to a celebrity fundraiser with Barack Obama. So he will not show up for Zelensky. It seems like one should do his job and worry about fundraising next. But what is garments and what is ghosts and new garments trying to take us back? What does it even mean? In new garments? The GOP wants to make it harder for blacks to vote? Nobody wants to make it harder for anyone to vote. We just want people who are supposed to vote to be able to vote, and if you're not supposed to vote, not be able to vote. That's in America. So a lot of people are saying that the president now at 37% approval rating should drop out. And a lot of people are saying that 538's Nate Silver, here's a quote. What's clearer, in my opinion, is that the Democrats would have been better served if Biden had decided a year ago not to seek a second term, which would have allowed them to have a semblance of a primary process and give voters a say among the many popular Democrats across the country. James Carville said the same thing. Cut four.
We have a choice to make in November, and it isn't a choice that I was crazy about. I actually was very public that I thought that President Biden should not run for re-election, but he did, and it's him and Trump, and that's where I am, and I'm 1,000% behind President Biden.
Yeah, and he's very down on him. His delivery is bad. His message is ridiculous. I'm going to give you information right now that I had no idea was coming, because I Wall Street for the most part has run to the Democrats, especially of late. I don't know why. It's in their best interest not to, but they did. And so big money's going there to be politically correct. You don't want to ever save for Trump. I'm not really sure why. People just accept that that's the case. But it is not the case anymore. Silicon Valley, $12 million in 3 hours with 100 people. Really? And Donald Trump did this thing called asking questions about cryptocurrency as well as AI to find out where the regulations should come in, the greatest fear that they have. The guy's learning all the time. Point Bridge Capital founder Hal Lambert, an investor and a Republican donor. Lambert is back Florida. Ron DeSantis is now supporting Trump. Blackstone CEO Steven Schwarzman, who once labeled the U.S. Capitol insurrection, following Trump's speech on January 6th, an affront to the democratic values of the country, is once again on the former president's team. Top financier Bill Ackman, who called out then-president to resign after the riots on January 6th, called him a three-time loser, is now considering supporting Trump. It suggested that Biden is a key argument that Biden's actions since 2020's defeat have made him unfit to lead the country, is falling flat. That's what they say that they're finding out. These CEOs looking around saying, this guy, the other guy got us. I also think, in my opinion, I'll ask Brian Brandberg this, when you go after the president's taxes, when you go after his finances, and you try to take $500 million from him because you feel as though that they paid undervalue the real estate that he purchased, that's scary to a lot of people. Because what if they got on the wrong side of people in power? John Katsimatidis owns WABC. We're lucky enough to be count them as an affiliate. Quote, I remember I got a mortgage in one of my homes I bought for the suburbs for $2.75. It's now over $7. He is worth $4.3 billion. He is now supporting Trump. Eric Levine, longtime GOP fundraiser, Treasury official, told Politico, the criminal cases brought against the former president were a factor on why he's supporting Trump. And lastly, Sean McGuire, Sequoia Capital, former Hillary Clinton supporter, pledged $300,000 to a pro-Trump effort minutes after the verdict. They're fed up. You tried to make the president radioactive. The exact inverse happened. I'm worried about July 11th because that's when they're going to get the sentencing. You put him in jail, give him house arrest. It's going to totally disrupt the country. It's going to make us a joke around the world, and it's not worthy of anything you charged him with. But I know yesterday he did not apologize for his crime, admit his guilt, that a lot of people do in order to get a lighter sentence. Trump's not like that. He doesn't believe that. He didn't do that. So David Sacks, co-founder of Kraft Ventures, multi-billionaire, why he hosted, by the way, J.D. Vance asked him to, but why he hosted the former president, cut six.
I think it's getting surprisingly big, Jesse. You know, when we agreed to do the fundraiser for President Trump, the goal was just to raise $5 million. And we weren't even sure we could do that because, as you well know, Silicon Valley is pretty much a liberal bastion. But we ended up raising $12 million. We had over 100 people there, and it really was a total love fest.
And, Pete, you know what? People like when you ask questions and you're legitimately curious as it leads to legislation. For example, everybody's got an expertise. I mean, do you think President Trump knows about farming? No. You know how many farmers he met with, how many people he met with? He meets with the agriculture secretary. Then they come up and they hatch out policy. What I love that Trump did when he was president is he'd bring those cameras into those rooms, whether it was guns or taxes. You'd hear the dialogue going back and forth. I thought that would continue. I didn't know we'd have an administration that was more shut off and cloistered than any in history that I can remember. That's what we're witnessing now. A huge step backward. Also, to see the Republicans converge around Trump is interesting. Governor Glenn Youngkin, somebody many people thought should be running for president, said this about Virginia. Three straight polls in a dead heat. Cut 10.
That's exactly what the polls are showing us. Just like Georgia and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, Michigan, Nevada and Arizona, those battleground states are seeing the exact same kind of statement that Virginians are making. They want a strong America. They want an America that has economic strength, not the Biden-generated economy that's unleashed inflation. They want an America that has national security strength, not the indecisive, weak America that Joe Biden has created. Common sense conservative policy works. We've unleashed a rip-roaring economy in Virginia, and I think they want to see it on a national level. Yes, Virginia is in play. We got 5 months of hard work. But I'm telling you, when they put the records of President Trump against President Biden, I believe that Virginians and Americans are going to find themselves pulling the lever for President Trump.
So Governor Glenn Youngkin is an impressive guy. His career is unbelievable. I met him at the State House in Virginia. I've seen him walk around to multiple events. I've seen him give speeches after looking at note cards, and they were almost verbatim for what he did. I see him interacting with people. It's sincere. Came down to a diner in Virginia twice. He showed up, worked everybody, went right to the kitchen. And he's somebody that's going to run for president, probably next. And I wasn't sure if he was going to get on board with Trump. But I think he'd be actually a strong running mate if he decided he wanted to do that. So I want to take a time out so I have some time on the other side. I want to talk about the ridiculous riots that are taking place in New York City and in Washington, D.C. for Hamas and the Palestinians. It is such an embarrassment and an affront and a danger to our country as they call for jihad, defile Andrew Jackson's statue, Rochambeau's statue, who played such a vital role in our revolution. And they have no problem doing it on Lafayette Square, a French legend who's done incredible amount for us, best friends with James Monroe, James Madison, and this guy named George Washington, as well as Thomas Jefferson. You just ask them. And those are the statues you defile just about a month until our 248th birthday. They don't care about America. These people just suck. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
So the day of January 6th that everybody talks about, the Democrats had hearings on. They talk about it literally every day. They got to run on two things, January 6th and abortion. So they have raw footage that's out, believe it or not, from Nancy Pelosi's daughter, who did an extensive documentary on it, was just following Nancy Pelosi's last day, her mother's last day as a speaker, and then January 6th happens. Now we have additional footage. And they talk about from her perspective that they try to get her and other leadership to Fort McNair and the people that breached the White House. Here is her ruminating about what Donald Trump has said all along, that she turned down National Guard troops to guard outside the Capitol after his speech on that day. Listen to this.
Why weren't the National Guard there to begin with?
They thought that they had sufficient
resources. There was not a question of how they had been. They don't know. They clearly didn't know, and I take responsibility for not having them just prepare for more.
Yep, because evidently Trump called and said this is going to be a big rally. They're going to go over to the Capitol afterwards, and you should be prepared for it. But you know why they weren't? My opinion. You know what was happening a week before there? That's when they surrounded the White House. They put the president into the basement. There was a series of things that happened where security was criticized for being too tough with protesters, you know, the George Floyd protesters, the anti-Trump protesters, being too tough. So then they didn't want the National Guard around. Nobody did, not the mayor of D.C. So when the Capitol was breached, there was no National Guard to be found. There wasn't enough Capitol Police. Technically, the president was in charge of National Guard and she was in charge of Capitol Police. Both failed, were undermanned and underprepared. We know that. But ultimately, the people that acted violently are violent, but they overstretched and overdid it. But here she is on tape talking about her responsibility during that whole thing. She now is coming out doing interviews saying Donald Trump's responsible. But remember how despicable she is. She lost me when she ripped up that State of the Union address for no reason, because she didn't like it. How dare she get a pass on that? And by the way, you know what's also irresponsible? Cavalierly, after resigning as speaker, going over to Taiwan and not deconflicting with our military or even asking the president, what are we doing? What are you doing over there? You know, it's a pretty hot situation. Now, I'm for going to Taiwan, but I would not have tried to show up the president, and China has not stopped the flyovers since she came over. She is such an overrated politician, self-centered, and lost her mind. I wish so much that she would just retire and go away. When we come back, Brian Brandberg on the Wall Street's attraction to the former president and our economy.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back, and we have Brian Brandberg with us, co-host of the Big Money Show weekdays at 1 o'clock, but you see him all over the channel. Brian, I thought it would be important for you to come in today because not only do you have that Midwest sensibility, you're also in New York.
That's right, yeah.
And you know where Wall Street is.
I used to live in Wall Street.
Right. I watched them go to Joe Biden, you know, swoon with Joe Biden. Write checks with Joe Biden. It seems like that has totally changed to a degree. I'm reading Politico today, and it's overwhelming. Eric Levine, longtime GOP fundraiser, Treasury official. He's a multimillionaire. He's going with him. Sean McGuire, partner at Sequoia Capital. Leaving Hillary, John Castamatidis, a New York billionaire, going all for Trump. Bill Ackman considering going after he was his biggest critic.
Right.
Blackstone CEO, Point Bridge Capital founder. Why?
David Sachs. Actually, Sachs put it interestingly. I think this captures the way these guys think. You know, when you are testing a new product, you do this thing called A-B testing. You take two right. things, you put them side by side, and you figure out which one worked better. The way he put it is, we basically got a presidential A-B test between Trump yeah. and Biden, and A was Trump, and it worked better, and that's going to work better for us. I mean, it's a really interesting way to think about it. You rarely get the chance to put two guys side by side and say, what was their track record like on foreign policy, on the economy, on the border, you name it. These guys are business guys. They're practical. At the end of the day, they have clear measures for what works and what doesn't, and they want to go for Trump.
Here's what Zach said to Jesse last night about what he found in the room when 100 Silicon Valley execs showed up. Cut eight.
We had a lot of people in that room who had never donated to Republicans before or to Trump. They were new donors, or they were had always been Democrat donors, and yet they came out. And I think I attribute that to the fact that Trump is making inroads in Silicon Valley.
Shocking. I mean, well, I thought they were so idealistic they'd be unable to open up their minds to this.
Yeah. It's interesting what time can do to how somebody thinks. You know, you have a theory 5 years ago that of how the world works and the way things are going to play out. And then you watch that theory play out. You watch energy play out. You watch regulatory policy play out. You watch border policy play out. You say, okay, well, if that's the way it actually happens, then maybe we can't keep doing that anymore. I mean, I think the one big problem for Democrats is they keep doubling and tripling down on the stuff they were talking about 5 years ago, and it hasn't worked, but they don't deviate. And so these guys, again, if you're practical, you just say, all right, if you're not going to deviate from what's not working, then I got to find – I mean, I don't know if they're in love with Trump, but they're just doing the calculation. They're Silicon Valley guys. They do calculations. They're doing it.
But here. Evidently, he did this thing called asking questions, and AI yes. and cryptocurrency yes. came up. How can you possibly be an expert on farming, crypto, and – you know, Wall Street, event, you can't. Real estate, you know, every president has their own expertise.
Right.
Especially AI. Do you know anyone? Maybe there's 10 people in the world that are on top of AI.
If there's 10 people in the world, that's pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
And he asked good questions, and he expressed concerns, but they got the sense that he was listening. I mean, that's a rare thing, right? Do you ever get the sense – this is an interesting question. You look at Joe Biden. Do you ever get the sense that the guy's really – listening
no.
to anybody and like inputting knowledge and saying, you know, maybe that should shape how I think. It's somebody else, and they're all doing pure political calculation. But Trump's actually engaging on the issues, and he's a business guy. I think he understands how to do that.
And that's what impressed David Sachs, because when it comes to cryptocurrency, you know, Trump has said, yeah, I don't want any part of that, you know, whatever. But you can't really say, I don't want any part of it. You know, you got to find out if I'm president, that might be my personal, I got to understand it. And what is the biggest complaint, Brian? If you might not know, it's okay. Mm-hmm. But that people in the crypto world have with this administration, because I know they're complaining about regulation
yeah.
with AI.
Oh, for sure. They what they hate is they feel like the way these guys deal with them is, and it's Gary Gensler at the and if they don't like what a guy in the crypto space is doing, they sue him. They don't have a policy or a rule that everybody can follow. They just find out they're getting sued, and they realize, oh, so now they think this is out of bounds. So now I've got to try to defend myself, even though I didn't know where the boundary was. So instead of laying out policy and rules, they just kind of shoot you down when they think you've gone too far. You can't run a space. You can't run anything without some boundary lines. It can't just be like a sue you if we don't like you kind of thing. Although – I will say that's kind of what America feels like right now, actually. It's sue you if you don't like you kind of thing. So, look, you don't have to love crypto, but people in America around the world think there's some possibility here. You owe them the right to make clear rules around it.
I do. I think you're right. I also think, too, do you think it bothers these men and women who run these major corporations when they're vilified as corporate gouging? Mm-hmm. You know, corporations have had it too good for too long. The corporate rate was reduced. Because we got to compete with other countries, yeah. Ireland and, every other European, the corporate rate was way too high. The president cut it,
yeah.
but not to make the CEOs richer, to make the companies more attractive, to bring them home.
He wants them to operate here so they create jobs for
people. And they're not going to do it if they can get less taxes in Ireland.
I mean, I think CEOs are pulled in two directions. One is they often run in elite circles, and those elite circles are liberal, and so they kind of have some affinity there. But on the other hand, there are people who have to make a bottom line. Like, they can't just issue debt endlessly and run up massive deficits and never pay the price for it like a president can. And so I do think they resent when a guy like that tells them you're a gouger, and they're saying, wait a sec, I've got to actually make a profit. Somebody's got to voluntarily invest their money here. We can't tax anybody.
So John Catsimatidis owns a bunch of supermarkets, Christie's and D'Agostino. Yeah. And he's saying, wait a second, you're accusing the supermarket owners of gouging prices? The margins are so small. They're responding to the cost of fuel, the truckers, the tolls, the delivery, the inflation.
The theft.
And now they got to find somebody to blame because these corporate guys are gouging. And now it's got to bother them.
It's absurd. And what it shows you, again, going back to something we said earlier, Biden's not interested in figuring out what's going on. He's just interested in finding a scapegoat. And if you turn out to be the scapegoat, you resent that. Like, wait a sec. You haven't even thought for a second about what I'm trying to do out here, what I'm dealing with. And by the way, your policies have made it harder for me. So, yeah, at some point, common sense kicks in and you say, you know what? Let's go back to that A-B test and figure out who's going to help us deliver groceries to people so they can afford it.
So I saw you were skeptical on the job numbers on Friday. Mm-hmm. Job numbers came in, but you said there was an imbalance that makes you feel as though there's a correction. Yeah. And we did notice the unemployment rate went up to 4% for the first time in a long time, which is still historically
that's
low.
That's a good unemployment rate.
But the numbers.
Yeah, my point was these are all numbers based on surveys. You survey businesses, that gives you the number that you see in the headline. But then you survey households and you ask them a set of questions about who's working and who's not. And those two surveys have the widest gap they've had in modern history, basically. Households are telling you jobs are disappearing. Payrolls are telling you they're being added. All I'm saying is when the gap is that big, something's got to give. And what we've seen repeatedly over the past several months is these revisions down in that jobs number. And I think it's because of that gap. We just don't have good data right now. And the problem is these policy guys are trying to make policy based on that data. And I just don't know that it's good data.
You mean especially interest rates and the Fed?
Federal Reserve trying to figure out the cut interest rates, raise interest rates. They're looking at this jobs data and it's all over the place.
So do you think that a lot of these are government jobs and part-time jobs? Is that part of it?
Huge. I mean, part-time jobs are almost all of it when you look at the net result of jobs added over the last year.
Just kids coming back to school.
It's kids coming back from school. It's, you know, maybe somebody picking up a second job. But it is not blocking and tackling solid private sector employment. That is not what it is. In fact, in those spaces, it's the opposite. These companies are figuring out – they're trying to figure out how to use AI to trim workforces, corporate workforces. They're not adding those jobs that are kind of like the – you know, the base load that keeps the economy going.
And the market's frozen right now. Because if you're in a 3% mortgage and you think to yourself, yeah, I want to downsize or I want to upgrade, why would it make sense to go anywhere? So even though 7% is historically not ridiculously high,
yes,
it is very damaging to your credit card bills, your student loans, and your house.
And it's because, yeah, it's not the 7%. It's how fast it went up.
Yeah.
We went from 3 to 7 like that. And everybody stuck with it. Well, everybody who can enjoy a 3% mortgage is like, even though I don't like my house, I'd be an idiot to sell it right now. But see, that goes back to policy. When you deny inflation and then all of a sudden have to realize it's there and jack up rates, it messes up everything in the capital markets for regular people who want to borrow to buy a house or a car or whatever.
I believe that Chairman Powell knew he was up for reelection or reappointment. And he knew that if he went and jacked up rates, that would be a reason that Biden would probably move on. So he holds the line until all of a sudden he realizes the only thing that could stop this spending would be to raise rates. And he did it rapidly.
What
do you think of my theory?
Look, I'm not him. But he blew it big time, and by all accounts, it looked like he and the Treasury Secretary and all the political guys were hoping against hope that inflation was just going to go away, and that's not how inflation works.
It's not right now. It certainly doesn't work, and it's hurting people across the board. Yeah. Brian, who you got on your show?
We got Senator Ron Johnson. We got Jade Warshaw talking housing and why nobody wants to sell and how to get into that. We got Apple, NVIDIA, lots of market stuff. So lots of good stuff today.
Right. With your housing, corporate housing, what role is that? Because I'm watching 60 Minutes about 2 or 3 years ago, and I'm saying, wait, major companies buying working class homes, middle class housing, holding it on to it, renting it to people, that could be shutting me out of the market.
Yeah. Well, and again, that happens when you get the biggest times we've gotten that were the housing crisis of 2008 when government housing policy failed and guys with cash jumped in. So if you create an environment where borrowing markets don't work, the big guys with the big cash get in the houses and it sucks out supply.
And your reaction to the wages, excuse me, not tipping wages, not taxing tips in the entertainment industry.
I like lower taxes everywhere at all times. I don't like picking and choosing winners and losers. I just want lower taxes across the board. That's what made Trump's tax cuts in 2017 so good. It worked for everybody.
I remember Reagan was the one who started taxing tips. You used to be able to walk out with your small paycheck at a restaurant because they only pay you like half of minimum wage because they know you're making tips.
Look, if we got no taxes on tips, that would be that would not be a world-breaking problem for me. I'd be happy for those folks. Give the little guy a leg up.
Right. All right. Brian Brinberg, we're going to watch you today at 1 o'clock on FBN. All right. Back in a moment. We're going to talk about the red wave that happened, the right-wing red wave that happened in Europe and what it means for us. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we're back, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. Glad to tell you what happened yesterday. Now, we're all zoned into our own election cycle, but do you remember when Brexit passed in London and Britain and they basically broke from the European Union? It took about 4 or 5 years, but they finally did it, but everybody was shocked. Then the next year, Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton. Everybody was shocked again. I think it's related. Well, yesterday, 4 days of elections have produced this. Europe is rocked with right-wing victories. It looks like people are sick of immigration. They're sick of this push for green energy. And they push back through the Le Pen party, 31% of the vote, as opposed to Macron's party, 15% of the vote. In Germany, the Socialist Party, with Scholz, 13.9%. The far right got 15.9%. You know what was invisible? The Green Party. In Italy, a Meloni's party got 28%. They look at her as a right wing, who's with a party that was based in fascism, but not now, was based on that. She is right wing, and people like what she's doing. Now she's going to be hosting the G7, and she's got additional power and a lot of swagger. I don't blame her. Could this be the canary in the coal mine, the precursor to a right wing victory here? We know the Senate can go either way. It leans towards Republicans. You know, with West Virginia evens it out, but they got to hold on to Texas and Florida. And they got to find a way to win somewhere else. And that win could be Montana. That win could be Ohio. That win could be Nevada. That win could be Pennsylvania. But they got to do it somewhere, somehow. But it happens usually in a wave. Usually they'll all win or just one will win. And West Virginia does seem to be a lock these days. So we'll see what happens. Keep an eye on that. Britt Hume weighed in on that last night. And he talked about what it really means. Now, we're not focused on Europe, but I love the fact that they are fed up with this whole green push. Listen to what he said, Britt Hume, Cut 32.
Across the Western world, we're seeing this resistance now to Green Party politics, especially in Germany, where the Greens did very badly. Mm-hmm. We're seeing resistance to unfettered immigration, which is a big issue, of course, here in the United States. And, you know, we're seeing concerns of the same kind that we have here in the United States about inflation and the economies. And that became, you know, a powerful force in these European parliamentary elections in which the prevailing majority parties did poorly and these insurgent conservative parties did better. Conservative parties referred to universally in the Western media as far right. I even heard you say it, Trace. And I think that if you look carefully at the results of these elections and what some of these candidates and parties ran on, we're talking about the same issues as I've just pointed out that we have in this country.
And it's in big time immigration. People are tired of it. People are proud to be French. They're proud to be Italian. They're proud to be German, and they don't know why people are opening up their borders and condemning them for speaking up. And they said, screw that. Now there's more of them. The people are speaking up, outnumber the other people that want to look down their nose at you and call you intolerant. But we'll see. I mean, that's part of the reason. I mean, Donald Trump seems legitimately happy. Hard to imagine a guy sits in court for 6 weeks, 4 days a week, gets convicted, and comes out happier because he's seen people gather around him, support him, and move forward. I mean, there are haters that don't know what to do with themselves. So Jordan Peterson weighed in on that. And he says, even as a psychologist, a conservative, who talks to more people on a given week than most, said this about, he can't quite figure out what the hatred of Trump is about, cut nine.
The degree of animosity that people have for Trump is actually somewhat of a mystery to me. I can't quite crack it. There's a class thing there. People, elitist people are annoyed that someone like Trump or someone who they think Trump is has dared to enter the upper echelons. So there's something about it that's very classist. And Trump is a brash, salesman-y sort of character, right? I mean, he ran The Apprentice for years. Is it Trump's rough edges? There's that. Is it his proclivity to bully? Which he does, and very effectively and sometimes very usefully. It's that. He's declassé, you know, and the elite types really hate that. They feel that he's contaminating their domain. It's something like that. It's very mysterious, and there's multiple levels to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's subsiding a little bit. I think people are sick of it, the hatred, and after a while they said, what is so bad? And also, I think this, over the weekend, you watch CNN, MSNBC, they spent the weekend telling everyone that President Trump, if he wins, is going to get revenge on people. But if you watch the interview with Dr. Phil and Sean Hannity, you know that they just did a follow-up question. He says, I'm not going to look for revenge. I'm going to be too busy. Success will be my revenge. But you can understand how people want me to do that. And you can understand that I might want to do that, but I'm not going to. So instead, they just made it's going to be revenge. Now I see the top story, Rachel Maddow, saying that she thinks that Donald Trump, if he wins, will put her in a camp with illegal immigrants. Really? I mean, do you really expect that to hurt Trump? Statements like that?
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. We come to you from Midtown Manhattan, but we're heard around the country, around the world. Unbelievably, I hate to say this, but three blocks away just a few weeks ago, an Indiana tourist was beat up by two illegal immigrants staying for free and getting free room and board right here. And sadly, that is the story. I interviewed a lawmaker that wants to be a state senator, wants to go into the assembly in Queens, AOC's district, where they've put a whole bunch of shelters in. Illegal immigrants all over there. A lot of them are gangsters. They are harassing and destroying the neighborhood, and their kids are in school. They're disrupting school. And this is the same area in which two cops were shot by this 19-year-old who has direct links to a bloodthirsty gang in Venezuela. With me right now in studio is Senator Dan Sullivan of Alaska on the Armed Services Committee, a veteran himself. In the bottom of the hour, we're going to talk to Steve Hilton about what's going on with these European elections, because I think it's significant and affects us here. Senator, always great to see you.
Brian, great to be on the show, and thanks for your great work. It's
first
awesome.
Up, a little bit of what is it like being a guy from Alaska when you come to New York City? Is it major culture shock?
Or? Yeah, it is. But, you know, there's a lot of energy here. There's a lot of energy in my state. It's just a little crowded, right?
Yeah.
But, no, it's good to be here, and there's a lot going on. And, you know, it's great to be on your show. And look, we got to make the case on a lot of these issues. You just talked about the illegals here. and
it's destroying the city.
Well, look.
Chicago and Philadelphia, Los Angeles and San Francisco.
Let me give you a stat, though, that a lot of people are surprised by. The state with the highest rate of fentanyl overdoses increase in fentanyl overdoses 2 years in a row, my state, 4,000 miles away from the border. Alaska has the Sinaloa drug cartels dealing fentanyl in our Alaska native villages. We are getting creamed in Alaska, killing Alaskans. This open border is such a disaster. It's a disaster in New York, as you mentioned, Chicago, LA. But it's a disaster in my state, too. And so, you know, sometimes it's good to come to New York and get the word out. This is hurting all Americans, even my constituents who live pretty darn far away from New York and the border.
Some people point out, well, if you look at percentages of crimes, illegal immigrants do a smaller percentage. It doesn't matter.
The
fact is, this is an unforced error, that all we have to do is do the basic thing by enforcing our border, controlling who comes in and goes out, or at least attempting to, and we can eliminate all of this. We could deal with Americans, but when we bring in people from outside we know nothing about, we stick them in, we tell them they can't work, but we're going to put you a free room and board and don't do anything wrong when they came here just to do that.
By the way, hundreds who were caught last year were on the terrorist watch list.
Over 300.
Right? And how many weren't caught, right?
Or how many countries don't report to? The FBI has no records of.
And, you know, so, the FBI director recently in a hearing was saying all the red lights are flashing on kind of a domestic terrorism hit because of the open border. It's an unmitigated disaster for every state in the country, including mine.
I was going to make it personal a little bit. William Smith College, it's a college that my daughter always plays in soccer. Both of them did. They are great sports school, a great school, William Smith in Hobart. Paige Gibbons doesn't do any drugs, 19-year-old freshman, did a Percocet with two of her friends, and it was all fentanyl and died right on the spot. Yeah. No history of drugs, A student, just one time. This isn't like, well, they drank too much, and it's, you know, those college kids.
Horrible.
These are people, some take Ritalin because they think, well, I got to stay up all night, helps me concentrate.
Horrible.
And they'll order from the internet. Got it from the internet, too.
Yeah, you know, I launched an initiative about 3 weeks ago in Alaska with our governor, his whole cabinet. It's called the One Pill Can Kill campaign. The whole point is to go out to Alaskans, especially our youth, and warn them about just what happened to the young lady you were talking about. You know, they can think that they're taking some kind of drug that's legal and use. And, you know, the FDA estimates that 7 out of 10 pills that are counterfeit, manufactured like that, have a lethal dose of fentanyl. It's unbelievable, and it's killing our youth.
Right. And again, I think the thing that's so lethal about it is it doesn't show a pattern of drug use, and you think, well, they got addicted. No, it's one and done.
But one pill can kill.
Senator, let's talk about what's happening over in Gaza, if we could. It looks like this administration is going to possibly deal directly with Hamas to get our hostages back. Wait a second.
Yeah.
They rescued four. We obviously provided the intelligence for that four.
Yep.
It was a daring rescue. We're focused on the people killed and getting those people back, not the journalist that was keeping the Palestinian journalist who was keeping three of the Israeli hostages, not the woman that was taken on the back of a motorcycle and basically lived through a horror scene. Not the 100+. It seems as though we're very comfortable criticizing the IDF and the Israelis.
It's unbelievable, Brian, and we should stay focused on what the mission is, and it should be the mission. It's certainly the mission for the IDF, but it should be the mission of the United States, which is to destroy Hamas. I can't believe the President of the United States and Secretary Blinken are pushing a ceasefire on Israel that they don't want. We need to be able to work with Israel to destroy Hamas the way that we destroyed ISIS, the way that we destroyed Al-Qaeda. And the fact that we're not doing that, and then here's the biggest issue. The grand puppet master in the Middle East, as you know, is Iran. And this administration's appeasement policy as it relates to Iran is what's fueling all the chaos. As you know, Brian, Iran funds, trains, and equips the Houthis, Hezbollah, in Hamas. And the Biden administration is 100% gloves off on Iran. The Trump administration had a great, very aggressive policy against them. They've lifted that, particularly the oil and gas sanctions. The Iranians at the end of the Trump administration had $4 billion in foreign reserves. They have close to $80 billion in foreign reserves today, 3.5 years later. And what are they doing with that? They're funding Hamas, they're funding Hezbollah, and they're funding the Houthis. That's the real strategic mistake here, that they won't even touch Iran.
So this so-called journalist working for the Palestinian Chronicle and for Al Jazeera was holding those three, and they have tax-exempt status in the U.S. called the People Media Project. So they're raising money, capturing. Yeah. So I don't know where to start. It's like the whole world is upside down.
Upside down.
So if you look at what's happening right now, I also see on the north, watching Israeli news, it seems that Hezbollah has found drones that could penetrate through Iron Dome. So they increase the sensitivity of it. And in doing that, there's all types of false alarms. So one of the batteries is actually blown up by a Hezbollah drone. Think about this. If they're allowed to continue to grow their arsenal and Hamas is allowed to survive, as they'll rebuild and come back more lethal than ever.
Yeah. And look, you're raising a really important point. Hezbollah is the real giant threat to Israel in terms of their sophistication with regard to weapons, like you're describing, in terms of their numbers. And so you are 100% right. At the beginning of this conflict, the United States said, hey, in the Biden administration, we're standing with Israel to destroy Hamas. And that is now gone. If they allow Hamas to survive, the signal that's not just going to send to Hamas, but as you're saying, right, to Hezbollah, which is the huge threat, is going to be not only unacceptable. The one thing that I say to my some of my Democrat Senate colleagues who are, you know, seemingly turning anti-Israel and more pro-Hamas, I'm like, go over to Israel. Go over. See the sense from the people that it's an existential threat to the existence of the country. I have been over there.
They want to blame Netanyahu. Oh, he's unpopular. What are you talking about? Benny Gantz was even, before he left, was not critical of the war effort. He was critical of the post-war effort.
Yeah.
And the way they fight is one thing. By the way, the IDF have not been flawless out there. They've been.
What military is flawless?
Right. But Corey Mills and company said that it's probably the most difficult terrain, more difficult than anything they fought with in Iraq, because they have a subterranean lifestyle going on, and their people are above ground in harm's way on purpose.
Yeah, hundreds of miles of tunnels. And, you know, the fact that this administration is now looking like, as you mentioned, direct negotiations with Iran and Hamas.
Right.
It's nuts.
Let's talk about rebuilding our military.
Yeah.
I know that we are a $36 trillion over budget. I know about the debt. I understand it's multiplying. But I can't see living in this world where the 3% of our GDP goes to the military below inflation.
Yeah.
What concerns you most? What action are you taking?
Well, look, the Biden administration has come to office, and every year they propose inflation-adjusted cuts to our military, undermining readiness. This is what Democrats do. Think about it. Carter, Clinton, Obama, now Biden. They cut our military. They gut readiness. The Republican tradition, as you know, is peace through strength. That's Reagan. That's Teddy Roosevelt. That's Donald Trump. That's Eisenhower. That's what we do. That's George W. Bush. That's our tradition. And we got to get back to that tradition, Brian, because it is a very dangerous world. Let me give you a very specific answer to your question. Right now, the Biden administration cannot build ships. We are dramatically shrinking the Navy. The Biden administration started with 293 ships, Navy ships, by 2027, which is when Xi Jinping says to his military, be ready to invade Taiwan, we'll be down to 280 ships. Meanwhile, the Chinese Communist Party, the People's Liberation Army, are dramatically increasing their military. By 2027, the Chinese Navy will be 400 ships to our 280. Think about that, 120 ship deficit. We have better ships, no doubt, but at a certain point, particularly in the Navy, quantity becomes its own quality, and we are overmatched in that region. And as you know, that will invite aggression. So we are marking up what's called the National Defense Authorization Act. That's a yearly bill that the Armed Services Committee marks up, and we are going to be undertaking a number of elements to get our shipbuilding back in order. That's Article 1 responsibility of the Congress, provide and maintain the Navy. That's what the founders of this great nation told us to do. The Secretary of Navy under Biden, I have confronted him on this. He focuses more on climate change, and I'm not kidding. He focuses more on climate change than shipbuilding and warfighting. You can't make this stuff up. We're going to usurp that. We have a number of provisions. And by the way, this is bipartisan. All the experts, the Congressional Research Service, came out 2 weeks ago when I met with them, and they said this is the biggest crisis of Navy shipbuilding, design, and manning our war vessels in 40 years.
But do you have an infrastructure to build the ships, or is it just money? Because I hear the bureaucracy is stopping the rapid building of ships, even if they were earmarked.
It's bureaucracy, it's lack of leadership, and it is infrastructure. One of the things that I'm trying to do in this bill, we'll see, the vast majority of our shipbuilding capacity is located on the East Coast. And so you have a problem getting workers. We need to make America a shipyard. All of America, right? Whether it's the Midwest, whether it's Alaska, whether it's the West Coast. Right. We've done this before. I'm just finishing up a great book called Freedom's Forge. I don't know if you've read it. It's all about how America's industrial base won World War II. We have the ability to do it. Reagan came up with a 600 Navy ship or a 600 ship Navy. We have the ability to do this. I think it's a great opportunity for President
Trump. And then
you
also got to wonder, too, with hypersonic missiles, how far you got to back the aircraft carriers from China. So you got to find a way to defend those missiles to save your aircraft carriers.
And we're working on that.
And you are.
And one other thing,
Senator
drone ships, too, right? Like, we need all kinds of ships. But right now, the U.S. Navy under Biden and the Secretary of Navy has no leadership, and the Congress is going to act. That's our constitutional responsibility.
It would be great if the State Department liked America. That would be certainly a nice surprise. Senator Dan Sullivan, our guest. Senator, there's got to be a massive input, not only that, with recruiting. We're down in almost every branch except the Marines.
Yes.
But I don't see one commercial that shows the glory of serving our country past generations.
Except on the Marines.
Right? Yeah, I would like to see it. I mean, you can be with the Army. All I see is these great organizations trying to help those who are wounded in battle. But it gives the wrong message. As people have told me, my kids don't want to join because they see everybody comes back beat up and maimed and somehow damaged. That's not the case for the majority. As hard as they fought, they still came back whole, and most people want to hire veterans.
I couldn't agree more, Brian. And look, even again on this NDAA, as we call it, I have an amendment that's going to provide much more access for our recruiters to high schools. Believe it or not, some high schools in America are like, hey, we don't want any of these recruiters on campus. Baloney, right? The recruiters, A, they can offer an opportunity for a young man or woman who might not know about it, but B, we're all in this together. You can't be a high school or a college saying, sorry, gotcha, I don't want any of those recruiters on campus. So we have a recruiting crisis. We got to get on it. If, you know, it's an all-volunteer military, and if we can't get the people to sign up, it's going to be a real challenge.
Senator, you have to run, catch a plane or a train?
Train.
Yeah, the train, Amtrak does not wait.
I know.
All right, Senator Dan Sullivan, thanks for the quality time.
Always great to be on the show.
Look for his bill to roll out there and support it. Thanks, Senator. Back in a moment with you guys.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Women's basketball got on my radar, like everybody's, because of Caitlin Clark. And the other girls in the league are delighted for her success. I'm joking, of course. They hate her. See, if this was men, they'd defend each other on their same team. Only women would do this. Well, women are catty, even the ones on her own team.
Bill Maher is not wrong. He's talking about Caitlin Clark. By the way, Bill Maher is a big sports fan. He was talking about Caitlin Clark and the fact that nobody in Indiana ever defends her, and she got hit again last night playing. And who is she? Out of Iowa, runner-up the national championship 2 years in a row, and the best player in basketball 2 years in a row. But Chad has been strong in the NBA, but, you know, just a rookie, ups and downs, not one of the top 12 players in the WNBA. So I don't have any problem with her not being on the Olympic team, although Dave Portnoy, who I really like, thinks I'm totally wrong. So pretty unbelievable that everybody's talking about it. And guess what? The WNBA has benefited. Fans attending WNBA games since the tip of the season, right, to the end of May. Popularity is up approximately 400,000 ticket sales. Do you believe this? Around the league, not just there. WNBA arenas were filled to a 94% capacity. Sellout games were up 156%. WNBA games were averaging 1.32 million viewers across the networks. Now it's through the roof. So she has definitely helped, but it doesn't seem like anybody cares. I don't think it's bad that the players are giving her a hard time. It just brings more attention to it. If Caitlin Clark was averaging 12 points a game in Indiana, a team that's one of the worst in the league for the last 2 years, I don't think people would be watching in that city when she came. But now the fact that people are hitting her and disparaging her, it's created more interest. Cut 34 is the commissioner of the NBA.
it's not nothing new in basketball that there's sort of welcome to the league moments, especially for heralded rookies. But of course, I want to see Caitlin treated fairly and appropriately in the league. I would say it seems like she can take care of herself. She's a tough player. I think it may be lost on some people who are new to basketball in terms of a little bit of the controversy in the WNBA. What an incredible talent she is. You know, two Final Fours, leading scorer, history of college basketball. So I look forward to watching her ongoing development in the league.
Right. That would be great. And, you know, people always bring up the fact that Magic Johnson wasn't accepted on the Lakers. They bring up the fact that Michael Jordan still doesn't talk to LeBron. The Detroit Pistons tried to beat the hell out of Michael Jordan when he started making a name for himself. People didn't like it. They resent when great players come in. But in terms of what she says publicly, she's not a ball hog. She doesn't disparage people on camera. Seems to be a good teammate. I like it.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Let's bring in Steve Hilton. Steve Hilton's a Fox News contributor, of course. Serves as director of strategy for the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, from 2010 to 2012, and might be having a big announcement about what office he's running for out in California. But first things first, Steve, you're the first person I thought of to put in perspective for the American audience why we should care about these European elections. And I remember very well, Brexit was the precursor to Donald Trump's 2016 election win. What does this European victory for the right mean?
Well, I think it's really an absolutely amazing parallel. It's 2016 all over again. I remember it really clearly. I was involved in the Brexit campaign. It was also my first year at Fox when we first met, Brian. I'm sure you remember it very, very clearly. Very special moment for you.
Absolutely.
And we were having this conversation back then, and you would ask me, along with all our colleagues at Fox, well, does this mean the Brexit vote, that we're going to see Donald Trump elected here in America? And I said, yes, it is the same sentiment, the same populist revolution that's brewing. And here again, we're back in the same position. Now, the issues are slightly different depending on the country. These were Europe-wide elections. The European Parliament, which sits above all the national parliaments, by the way, that was one of the reasons for the Brexit campaign, is that you've got these kind of multinational organizations which have more power than the individual parliaments in each of the countries. But the issues are slightly different. In Germany, it was mainly driven by the green agenda, the extremist green agenda that they've been pushing for the last few years, because the Green Party did really well in these elections last time around, 5 years ago, and then they've also done well in domestic elections, so you've had a big green push, and just as we see here, it's really, really pissed everyone off, because it pushes up prices, and it's telling people how they live their lives, and so on. People have had enough of it. So in Germany, a lot of it was anti the green extremism. In France, by contrast, a lot of it was the immigration issue, because there you've seen the impact of uncontrolled immigration, and you see people's concerns rising, just as we see here, about crime and the impact on the economy and wages, and also their culture and society. But actually sitting above it all, just as we see here, is the economic question. There's economic malaise that has been very evident here with inflation and people's earnings not rising to keep up. And all the story we see here in terms of the economy, it's actually even worse in Europe. And so it's a big combination of those factors. And in exactly the same way as we saw a rejection of the establishment in Europe as a precursor to the rejection of the establishment here in America in 2016, I think it's happening all over again.
So how does the EU elections relate to the individual nation or national elections?
Well, it's incredibly complicated and ridiculous, and one of the reasons I felt so strongly about leaving the EU. So you've got basically three parts of the European government, and all of it is, if you like, superior to the national governments. Think of it like our federal government in Washington and the state governments. You have the European Parliament, which is the equivalent of Congress. So it's a massive body. There's like 700 or 800 people elected, something like that, from each of the countries, direct elections to that body, as if it's the congressional elections, midterms or something like that. That's basically what we've just had. You've got the European Parliament that's directly elected. Then you have the European Commission, which is the bureaucracy of the European European government. That is the, if you think about that, as the swamp in Washington, the individual agencies and departments. And then you have the European Council, which is made up of the actual representatives, the prime ministers, from each individual country. So you've got this three-part structure. But the really outrageous thing is that the power to initiate policy, to start different ideas and get them going and put them into motion, it rests with the bureaucracy, with the unelected part, the European Commission. They are the people who actually drive things. And all this other stuff, the European Parliament and the Commission and all the rest of it, is just basically trying to play catch-up with the bureaucrats who are really in charge.
So Le Pen party, way to the right. I don't love how cozy she is with Putin. It makes me extremely worried. But she got 31% of the vote. The Macron party, 15%. If I say anything that's not accurate, I wrote this down at 3 in the morning. Le Pen, 31%. She got 31% of the vote, her party. Macron's party, 15%. And he immediately calls for elections.
Yeah.
Why does he want to call for elections strategically?
It's a really, really interesting question and a massive, massive gamble. So he is gambling. This is what's the National Front, which has now been renamed, but that's the origin of this party. Marine Le Pen's party was founded by her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, many years ago. And you could say he really was, as it were, far right. Since she took over, she's been moving it more and more towards the mainstream, actually changing not just their branding and how they present themselves, but a lot of their policies as well, to make the party more in the mainstream. And as she's been doing that over the years, she's now run for president twice. She's done better each time. And her party is doing better and better in regular parliamentary elections. And each time that they've had an election, you've had this unified chorus from the establishment parties, Macron and the others, in France, who don't really engage with Marine Le Pen's arguments on policy, on immigration or any of these other things. They just say, you can't have these people in power. They're unacceptable. It's the far right. That's really all they say. And he's trying that again. And his response to
Steve, could I talk to you about that? Can I just stop you? Does that sound familiar? They don't want to talk about Donald Trump on crime. They don't want to talk about him on foreign policy. They just want to say he's unacceptable. He's unhinged. He's a convicted criminal. Go ahead, sir.
Exactly the same. And so he's trying it again. So Macron's response to the elections was, this is terrible. It's unacceptable. It's basically, he literally said, unbelievably, although you could say at least he's honest and transparent, I cannot come to terms with these results. Basically, I can't accept it. You, the people, have spoken, and I just can't accept it. So what he's done with this decision to have snap elections, which he didn't have to do, but he does have the power to call them, to dissolve Parliament and say, right, we're going to have new elections just here in France, not European elections, here in France. He's gambling that that message will work again. He's trying to scare people in France with the specter of a far-right takeover and said, look at these results in Europe. It's terrible. This is the return of the far-right and the Nazis and all the rest of it. And so we have to reject it. We, the people of France, have to come together to reject it. And I'm going to give you the opportunity to reject it immediately by having these elections just within a few weeks. It's a massive gamble, because what could happen is exactly the opposite, which is that people say, sorry, we're not going to be told by you that we can't have the policies we want. You failed on immigration. You failed on the economy. We want a change. And so what you could end up seeing is actually Marine Le Pen, and this is what's happened every time they've tried this, she's done better and better and better. That could happen again just in a few weeks, and her party could win more seats in the parliament, and that means that Macron would be facing, just as we see here, divided government. At the moment, because his party can put together a majority in the parliament, he gets to appoint a prime minister from his own party, and it's basically they're running the show. It's very possible that actually this gamble will backfire, and he ends up basically being completely hamstrung. He doesn't have the ability to get his agenda through because he has effectively Marine Le Pen's party in power in his own parliament. It's a massive risk.
I'm going to run through a couple more countries. In Germany, the Socialist Party, when I jotted it down this morning, had 13.9% of the vote, and that's Scholz's party, and the far right at 15.9%. The Green Party was just a non-factor. I thought that's where they took root, the Green Party.
Exactly. It's the first country in Europe where they've had a real strong political presence. This is going back to the 1970s. And they've been part of the government there for a long time. and they've been doing better and better, and they had a fantastic result in the European elections, these equivalent elections 5 years ago, which was a sent shockwaves, and it was the big message. You know, the green agenda is now center stage, and people want this transition to the new energy future, blah, blah, blah. And it's just been completely rejected, a massive collapse, including among younger voters, which is where their strength lay. They've collapsed across the board because, again, it's this rejection of the practical consequences of this ideology. So it's easy to talk about how we're going to have the green energy transition and it's all going to be great. But when it comes down to it, if you force it through too quickly, exactly as we're seeing here with these ridiculous deadlines that they set for getting people into EVs and whatever, and getting rid of fossil fuels, even though we don't have the power capacity to run the grid efficiently and reliably without the existing mechanisms or nuclear power. Remember, in Germany, they did. Angela Merkel took the incredibly stupid decision to shut down their nuclear power plants in the wake of the Fukushima disaster in Japan, which, by the way, is, we should always remember, no one died from any kind of nuclear aspect of that. It was the tsunami that killed people. And so she, you know, wildly overreacted to that, shut down nuclear power. That made them more dependent on Putin's gas, for example, and increased energy prices, and people have had enough of that. So it's the same far-left ideology which has been adopted by the establishment here in America, just as in Europe, that's just been rejected.
So that I love it, by the way. Italy, the Meloni party,
yes,
that they say is based in fascism, or the party was birthed there, but it's changed to a degree. She got her party got 28% of the vote. They feel as though they host the G7 now. She feels, yep, emboldened. Does she have a right to be?
Absolutely. That's the one area where an incumbent, the one country where an incumbent actually did well. And surprise, surprise, it's the one party that is responding to people's concerns, particularly on immigration. Remember, in terms of immigration, in a way, Italy, you could think of for a long time as the Eagle Pass of Europe. They had all of the focus of the illegal immigration coming in from the Middle East and elsewhere across the world. A lot of it was landing up literally on the beaches of Italy, particularly southern Italy, Sicily, and so on. And that was one of the factors that propelled her to power. And they all said, just like Marine Le Pen in France, they said she's a fascist, she's a Nazi, whatever, far right. She's actually turned out to be a very impressive leader of the country, and she's working to control immigration, just as she promised. She's actually very strong on the Ukraine war, much to people's surprise, and as emerging as a really impressive leader, and she's been rewarded for it.
It's fascinating to see, because I look around and people are just outraged about what's happening at the border. I look around, people are outraged by the utility bills. They want to, yeah, be responsible with the environment, but they think this extremist buy an electric car will subsidize the whole thing, make dealerships taking these cars. They can't move them off the lot. They're buried in debt. They have small margins to begin with. Where is the common sense? And that's
it's
what
ridiculous.
Europe seems to be saying.
Exactly. And we need that here. And just to bring it home to where I am in California,
ridiculous.
It is just insane, right? They're clamping down on our own energy production here in California. I was just in Bakersfield the other week. You've got massively successful industries there that are being completely crushed. And it doesn't mean that we're no longer using oil and gas in California. What does it mean? Instead of actually producing it here and getting it, you know, just from where we produce it to the places it's used with minimum environmental, you know, consequences, what are they doing? They're now importing it. We're importing oil and gas from places like Iraq and Venezuela on the dirtiest form of transportation on Earth, which is these giant super tankers that use bunker fuel that produce, you know, more emissions than all the cars on the road in California put together. I mean, it's just totally insane, all in the name of this claiming that they're green. It's not even green, even on their own terms. It doesn't make any sense. It is just ridiculous.
You know, it's so interesting because that's what Trump was saying over the weekend. He wasn't saying get conservatives. He was saying common sense.
Exactly.
And that's what we want to do. I'm just so hopeful that I just thought a whole generation has been brainwashed into thinking the earth is going to explode unless we stop fossil fuels immediately. And now I'm seeing that there's a different, people are sobering up in Europe. I hope it happens here.
Exactly. It's and we've got to make the argument in a thoughtful way, right? Because sometimes if you sound as extreme as they do, you lose people. But if you just put the argument in a sensible way, it says, look, fine, okay, over the long term, it would be great if we could transition to a different way of powering our economy, and we could make it cleaner and more reliable, and nuclear power has to be a huge part of that, and so on and so forth. That's great. Let's do it in a sensible way that helps our economy and helps families and businesses instead of crushing them, which is what we're seeing now, because you're rushing it. And I think everyone can respond to that argument.
So Silicon Valley, Steve, is a perfect mix of your skill set. Silicon Valley hosted Donald Trump, and they raised $12 million. And I thought this was, if you told me this a year ago, I go, really? Are you kidding me? $12 million to his opponent? No, to 12. Here's what David Sachs said about what he's seeing now. Cut eight.
We had a lot of people in that room who had never donated to Republicans before or to Trump. They were new donors, or they were had always been Democrat donors, and yet they came out. And I think I attribute that to the fact that Trump is making inroads in Silicon Valley.
So is he?
Yes, and I hear, and it's really interesting. This was the visible manifestation of something that I've been seeing a lot, which is in private conversations, exactly as David was talking about here. I know David well. I know Chamath, who is the co-host. I know these people, and so I've watched their progress, as it were, in terms of understanding that you just can't go on with this far left ideology. But it's not just them, and you see it in private conversations all the time, and people looking at, and it's a combination of things. It's the far left is the consequences of the far left ideology right here on the ground in California, including in Silicon Valley, obviously San Francisco, which in a way isn't the heart of Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is more the suburban towns and cities south of San Francisco. But they are in San Francisco the whole time. Often they have two homes. They have one in San Francisco, one down here where I am right in Silicon Valley. And they see the chaos and the disorder and the crime and dysfunction. And they say, we can't go on like this. Then they see the ridiculous attacks on business. In particular, they're really fed up with what you're seeing from this the Federal Trade Commission, and just they feel kind of ridiculous anti-business assaults right across the board. The venture capital industry very fed up with all of that, and the taxation that means that they can't make money and invest in the companies that will grow in the future. And then they look at Biden and say, honestly, it's just an embarrassment. We can't have this guy. All of these factors come together, and I've seen in conversations, literally at dinner parties and so on, where they say, you know what, I don't know, I can't really tell anyone, but I think I might have to vote for Trump. And they would never have said that even a year ago.
Right.
It's really, really changing.
Yeah, we tried the Gavin Newsom way. The border's wide open. The homeless is out of control. Taxes are through the roof. Thanks a lot. You're ruining the best state in the country.
Exactly.
Steve Hilton, thanks so much. Appreciate
great
it.
Great to be with you.
1-800-COMPETENCY in Europe. I just got that course, and I will pay you my tuition. I appreciate it. Back in a moment with your calls. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Some of the most progressive and left parts of the Democratic Party are standing for the kind of side that have kinds of organizations like Hamas or these kind of nations that there are no rights for women, and they certainly don't embrace the LGBTQ kinds of no, lifestyle. No. And in Philadelphia, the Queers for Palestine blocked the Pride parade in Philadelphia. And I never saw that on the bingo card. But
I mean, think about that. Senator Fetterman makes more sense than almost anybody in Congress. I find him like a little like Bill Maher, a little like Joe Manchin, in that they team speak logically instead of ideologically, and I find it totally refreshing. He is 100% right with Israel. It looks like Hamas has accepted this ceasefire. Let's see if they do it. But it's so bad. You got to let them finish him off. This Sinwar and company are alive. He is going to come back stronger with better arms, with more damaging hits, and they're going to start focusing on us. It is absolutely insane that we're forcing this deal on them and Netanyahu and so stopping them from going in full bore and not highlighting the fact that four people were hostage. These four hostages were rescued in a brilliant way, the most courageous way you could imagine, with a commander in front who lost his life, sadly, in two separate locations and flew everybody out. And then you find out one of the people keeping three of them in a high rise is a journalist.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. We're at 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. But you know, we're a national show heard around the country and the world, and we're thrilled to be going to Dallas tonight and going to be at Kubi's tomorrow, this legendary place in Dallas, doing Fox and Friends, and then going to KLIF Studios to do the radio show again. So we won't miss a beat. We're continuing to expand the breadth and the reach of the show. WTIC in Hartford just signed on. They began yesterday. Been talking to their great lineup, too, so it's definitely a thrill. So before we get to Mary Catherine Hamm, let's get to the big three.
Now with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
We don't know if Hunter Biden is actually going to be found guilty. I think he will. We don't know, even if he's found guilty, whether he will go get a real prison sentence. Joe Biden will pardon his son to spare him a prison sentence after the election, one way or the other.
Yeah, so there we go. The Hunter trial. The jury deliberates continues today in Wilmington. We review the slam dunk gun case in favor of the prosecution. And we have just heard a verdict has been reached in the Hunter Biden gun trial. Don't move.
Number two.
Some of the most progressive and left parts of the Democratic Party are standing for the kind of side that have kinds of organizations like Hamas. And I never saw that on the bingo card. But
Senator Fetterman is 100% right. Can you imagine this? Breaking up the gay pride parade, queers for Palestine. A cease peace deal. I hope Israel walks away from it. As a frustrated Blinken and Biden say, if you walk away from it, Israel, and Hamas doesn't agree, we'll deal with Hamas ourselves. Suddenly they're making Israel the bad guy every single day. I really thought we have friends and we don't deal with terrorists. But what am I thinking?
Number one.
But let's be clear. They're all ghosts. And New Garment's trying to take us back. Taking away your freedoms, making it harder for black people to vote. Or have your vote counted. Trying to erase and rewrite history.
Sickening. Absolutely sickening. 2024, money and support flowing in from the most unlikely sources. Wall Street and Silicon Valley for Donald Trump. As President Biden uses a Juneteenth concert to label Trump a racist and Republicans racist. Mysteriously freezing McConnell style during the concert. So Mary Catherine Hamm's with us shortly, but the big news is, of course, it just came as I came on the air, a verdict to be read in the Hunter Biden trial. So let me see. They've been deliberating just a few hours. It seems an obvious case. He checked the box that said he wasn't on drugs. He bought a gun. They did toss it into a dumpster by his girlfriend at the time, Beau's widow. He did text at the exact time how he's meeting with the crack dealer. The question is, with a hometown jury, would they ever convict a Biden with all the Bidens staring at him? And now the Bidens are scurrying back in to see what's happening. So Jonathan Turley looked at this case. Is Mary Catherine Hamm there? Okay, great. So Mary Catherine, welcome. Congratulations. I'm so glad you're back in the Fox News family officially.
Oh, thank you very much. Glad to be back. It's going to be a blast.
And also, you're a columnist for Outkick and host of the podcast Getting Hammered.
Great.
So I was going to talk to you about this right away, but a verdict has just been reached in the Hunter Biden trial. In terms of the bones of the case, there's no question he's guilty. But what do you think this jury? What do you think this jury thinks?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, like you say, hometown jury. Like, how can you not be exposed to the Bidens if you're a Delawarean? But the question is, I think that the defense hung their whole case on the idea that he didn't knowingly violate the law by knowingly checking this box because he was in denial about being addicted to crack cocaine. And it's like, look, man, it's in pictures. It's on video. It's on your laptop, which we all know is real now. It is in writing in your memoir, okay? Like, everyone could tell what was going on. You knew what was going on. And on one hand, I think for the left, the thing that they have to recognize, this is a paperwork crime, right? But on the other hand, nah, it's a gun crime. This is a very dangerous and volatile person at the time who had not sought treatment, who had not been treated and was having access to a firearm, which he and his sort of hapless paramour, Hallie Biden, who is the former wife of his deceased brother, end up jumping in a dumpster in public, at which point the gun then disappears. And police luckily were able to recover it, and it didn't come to any further harm to anyone at that point. But this is a dangerous situation.
Yeah, I mean, I still don't know why he wanted a gun, but listen to it. Before we get the verdict, there's different things in how it's going to affect the race overall. People want to say there's no two tiers of justice because you got the president's son being tried right after the former president. Here's what Alan Dershowitz said, Cut 24.
The best thing that could possibly happen to Donald Trump is if Hunter Biden gets acquitted, because the evidence against Hunter Biden is so much more compelling. The legal issue is so much more compelling than anything against Donald Trump. And it will prove beyond any doubt that this is all about where the trial was conducted, that if you're Trump and you're tried in New York, it's automatic guilt. And if you're Biden and you're tried in Delaware, it's a different verdict. So the best thing that could possibly happen to Donald Trump is the acquittal of Biden based on all this evidence. It would also be a good thing for America. It would uncover and disclose the horrible double standard that our criminal justice system is going through.
What do you think of that school of thought?
No, I don't think he's incorrect politically, and I wouldn't be surprised if they do acquit him. Look, the only reason he's paying even the bare minimum price of going to court to defend himself is because whistleblowers and a keen judge saw through the plea deal and the covering up that the federal Department of Justice was attempting to do on Hunter Biden's behalf. Right? Like, that's the only reason we're here. Some on the left have argued, like, well, if the Bidens really controlled the DOJ and things were this double standard, then why is his son under trial at trial? Only because someone else made that happen, right? Against the wishes of federal prosecutors who were trying their best to keep him out of trouble. So it's important to keep that in mind. And I think politically that's correct, that if he's acquitted, it does sort of lay bare what Donald Trump is always talking about.
So, Mary, were you at CNN during the 2020 cycle?
I was, yes.
What was it like from when the laptop was exposed and when the New York Post Twitter account was suspended,
right,
and when Kayleigh McEnany had her account suspended for saying that it was real? What was it like then, and what do you think now?
Well, I wasn't in the office much because they didn't have us in there, but I will say that, like, the media mass delusion about that and willingness to totally take for granted the idea that this obvious piece of evidence, which, by the way, is now, like, in evidence in a court trial, to act like it was fake, to act like it was fake on behalf of, let's face it, just the Biden campaign trying to keep him out of trouble and to try to keep dirt off of Joe Biden himself. It was appalling. It was appalling. They didn't stand up for fellow media in the New York Post, one of the oldest newspapers in the country, being kicked off of Twitter over this and censored over this. They still, to this day, just as in Russiagate, don't stand up to power in the intelligence community, abusing its authority and its alleged expertise to say in public that this thing was Russian disinformation when it absolutely was not. It's just his son's laptop. That's all it is. And it's chock full of information about the dealings that went on between father and son and the very reckless personal life of his son. And all of that, look, I don't know if it would have made a difference in the election, but it should have been brought to light and it should have been treated like it was real. And anyone who said that was treated like a crazy person.
How about
particularly in my former network?
how about the debate? The debate when he said, I have nothing to do with my son's overseas business dealings. That's wrong. When he said
right.
that 51 intel agents weighed in and said it's Russian disinformation, that was wrong. How about he said, I have no business to do with China, that you're the ones who has business to do with China? That's wrong. So this, all the accounts that have come up, the shell companies that have emerged, people might say, well, maybe this guy isn't as pure as the driven snow, the poorest senator in Congress before
right.
he became vice president. So it could have, you would absolutely have to reconfigure who was being nominated and maybe who was elected. And to me, that's never been reconciled. James Clapper, who I'm sure you dealt with, is one mm-hmm. of the 51 Intel people. And when asked, do you regret putting your name on that? He says no. Do you believe all 51 people should be asked about this to justify what they did or asked to apologize?
Absolutely. Like, I think people should pay consequences for these things. James Clapper lied to Congress before, right, about NSA programs. And then he's lied repeatedly in public, and yet he is treated as an expert on intelligence and as an expert in public trust. The irony is screaming at us, right? And one of the things that bothers me about the Trump era is that many people in media and in the intelligence community and in law enforcement decided that if you're lying and abusing the system for the right reasons, that's fine. And then they lecture the rest of us about not being upset enough about lying or living in a post-truth society. And it's like, you guys are engaged in post-truthiness every day of the week and twice on Sunday, okay? And you're doing it to Congress under oath. So forgive me if I'm not going to trust you about this kind of thing anymore.
In 2024, if you want to make my goal would be as a politician and a leader to level the playing field, to make every group have equal shot and equal access. So there's bias. Let's get rid of it. But in terms of giving money or pandering to one group or sect, I thought those days were pretty much over. But Joe Biden at Morehouse when he gave his commencement address, and then yesterday on the Juneteenth concert. Listen to him yesterday, cut two.
But let's be clear. They're all ghosts in new garments trying to take us back. Well, there are. Taking away your freedoms, making it harder for black people to vote. Or have your vote counted. Closing doors of opportunity. Attacking the values of diversity, equity, and inclusion. If you can believe it, banning books about black experience in America. Trying to erase and rewrite history. Our history is not just about the past. It's about our present and our future.
Your thoughts about that tone?
First, a scintillating public speaker he is. When I can understand him, it is just a really depressing and speaking of post-truth message, because all that stuff about taking people back, which, by the way, against Romney, you'll remember, he was like, oh, they want to put you back in chains. Just the most outlandish, divisive rhetoric while calling everyone else divisive. Either they want to take us back, they want to take away your freedoms, take away your right to vote and make it harder for you to vote. That's, of course, a reference most recently to the Georgia reformation of voting rules, which has been completely debunked that that was some sort of regressive, terrible, racist bill. Of course, it was not at all. And there are many states, including Delaware, that have stricter rules than Georgia does. Everything has gone swimmingly since then, particularly with the black vote in Georgia since that time. But they lie. They just lie.
Two things I want to fill you in on. One, it looks like Hamas, at least one official, has accepted the peace terms and Netanyahu reiterated that he would accept it or cease fire terms. And Hunter Biden is found guilty on all charges, faces 25 years in prison. Your thoughts about the Hunter situation?
About the Hunter situation, I'm a little bit surprised, frankly. I think it is correct that this will not, this ends up looking like a justice system that is responsive to evidence in this case, and that he may actually pay some sort of price for having documented many criminal offenses in his past, despite the fact that he's the president's son. The president did not want that to come to pass and, in fact, used a bunch of his power to prevent it. But here we are.
And now Hamas accepting the terms, seemingly, if we're to believe this?
Unlike the American press, I always take Hamas's word with a grain of salt. So let's see where this plays out. But one would hope that in the medium term, we could at least get a few more hostages back, which, of course, many on the left have not been celebrating, but I celebrate every time we're able to do so.
So, Mary, a heck of a first appearance. You're able to provide commentary on the latest Biden speech, the first Hunter conviction, and Hamas's possible ceasefire. Besides that, not much happened during these 7 minutes.
Yeah, just a few things.
All right. She's a columnist on OutKick, host of the podcast Getting Hammered, and she's a Fox News contributor. Mary Catherine Hamm, thank you.
All right. Take care.
All right. Back with more perspective on this breaking news.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
The prosecutors did an extraordinarily good job here. They were focused, they were disciplined, and they methodically took apart each of these defenses in front of the jury. And when you pursue a nullification strategy, it can go too far sometimes. It make the jury feel like they're being treated as chumps.
So we're just looking at the aftermath of the verdict that came down relatively quickly. I think they started deliberations, I guess, officially 9 a.m. Here we are 2.5 hours later, and you have a verdict on the Hunter Biden trial, guilty on all counts. And look, we've been looking at this case. None of us are legally trained. And we just you have text messages that lead you right through it. You had video of Haley Biden throwing out the gun. You have text messages of saying, "Hey, I'm at 7-Eleven buying crack from Mookie, my dealer," and talking about how he's addicted and we can't do this anymore. And it was all there, residue on the bag. Having said that, the reason why this is delayed, the reason why a deal wasn't done, because it was a sweetheart deal that was going to be agreed on that no clear-thinking judge could sign off on, number one. And number two, the real damage was the registering as a foreign agent, the FARA violations, they expired. That was the one that landed Paul Manafort in jail for 25 years and put him in solitary confinement for months. This was much more extensive, many more countries, and could have compromised the sitting president of the United States. Now, he's looking September 6th, I think, at tax charges. So it makes one think that you would have to come out with some type of sentence prior to that on these gun charges. I mean, would be a first-time violation of a guy that clearly, according to his laptop, which we know is real, has been doing illegal drugs for quite some time, dealing with prostitutes pretty regularly, and not being called on it. Everybody's been paying his bills. His dad's name has blocked everything for him. Now you have these guys in Hollywood putting money together in order to pay for a pristine, top-shelf legal defense. And then he gets to live in the White House, gets a brand new marriage, brand new kids, gets to start again. I have no interest in Hunter's life. I really don't. It's just how it relates to the president and how many times he looked in the camera and just flat out lied. My son has done nothing wrong. My son is the smartest one I know. How about I don't know anything about my son's overseas business dealings when text messages and emails say a different story. Then you show up at different events and go to different dinners and lunches, and you say you didn't talk anything about the deal. We see pictures of you golfing with his business partners, but he got away with saying, "I know nothing about my son's business dealings." They just talked about the weather and small talk. Really? This is what happens. My feeling is this. They're going to say that justice is equal, but if justice was actually equal, we would have had this in 2020. Justice actually equal. This is way delayed, and because of a sweetheart deal in his home state of Delaware, this is what punted that deal a year ago that got us to this court date today. And even though you paid a ton of money for Abby Lowell, he did nothing effective because you gave him absolutely no leeway. You led everyone to it. You admitted to it. You took pictures of it. The day they authenticated the laptop, which really should have been 2020 when it was dropped off, was the day this guy was found guilty. When we come back, my extensive interview with one of the most successful sports executives in the world, UFC president Dana White, his relationship with Trump, his relationship with Rogan, and, of course, the latest on these details of Hunter Biden's conviction on all counts, a fine of $750,000 maximum and 25 years in prison. Brian Kilmeade Show.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So it's official. Hunter Biden convicted on all counts. He has showed no emotion. The verdict was read. He showed no emotion as he looked to his legal team, and he says, "It's all right," to Abby Lowell. He walked out, passed the defense's table, hugged and kissed his wife, and left the courtroom. He could be facing 25 years in prison, a $750,000 fine, and that's the story. Meanwhile, I had a chance to interview Dana White. I wanted to share with you, unedited, here's a look at the most successful CEO in sports.
So, Dana, what I also find amazing, too, is what you created, especially since the pandemic ended, the entrance of your VIPs. You mentioned the president of Ecuador was here, the president of Spain watches. You also, like when President Trump walks in, he's treated like a rock star. You guys usually walk in together. And the one thing I think you appreciate about the former president, maybe future president, is he was there early with you. How much does that matter to your relationship?
Yeah, loyalty is really important to me, and he's been a very good friend to me. And he's a massive fight fan, you know? And it's not this thing, the UFC got popular, so Trump, but whatever. Trump was the guy who reached out to us when we couldn't get venues and had us come to the Taj. We did our first two shows over there. And when you think about it then, the Trump brand here, the UFC brand here, he showed up for the first fight and stayed till the last fight for both events. He's the guy who would reach out to me my entire career when good things happen and say, hey, congratulations, I always knew you were going to do it. He was one of the guys, too, that actually got in with another group and started to compete against us. But I would never say anything negatively about Trump because he was such a good friend and such a big supporter.
And then how has that relationship grown as he became president? Next thing you know, the guy who's a fellow promoter, entrepreneur, builder, he's president of the United States. Is he still calling you?
Yeah, I talked to him last night, yeah. We talk all the time. He is a really good friend of mine. I really care about him as a person. His family, I mean, Jared Kushner is an incredible human being. Ivanka is an incredible human being. You know, I'm close to him and his family. So, and it'll be that way till we both die.
Ivanka trains now.
Yeah.
So, and her family trains now?
Her kids are doing jiu-jitsu, which was brilliant. They got their kids into jiu-jitsu. And so what's crazy is her and Jared came to their first fight. I think it was in Miami last time we were there. It was their first fight for 4 days. Those two couldn't stop texting me saying, this is crazy. We've been to everything you could possibly go to. We've never been to anything as fun as that. Or maybe it was 300 they went to. I can't remember. But
when they step out, what is it like? Why does your audience seem to like the former president so much?
Well, the thing is with our fan base and our fighters, we're all very aligned in life and everything else. And it's not that it's any real political side. We're for common sense. It's all everybody's looking for. Everybody wants the same thing. There's no difference. And anybody in this room, if you let all the media BS go away, we all want to make a good living. We all want to get a house. Right. We want some nice cars. We want kids. We want to take care of our kids. We want our kids to do well and go to college. Everybody wants the same thing. It's not like we don't. It's just the media has created this divide in this country that needs to go away, and hopefully soon it will.
That's why I'm honored, because I know you hate the media, and you've made that pretty clear lately. Yeah. So thankfully for now, I made the cut. But the president asked you to speak at the RNC, mm-hmm. and you said that a lot of your friends said to you, don't do it. You did it, and I was there. You killed it.
Thank you.
Are you glad you did it?
Yeah, everybody told me not to do it. But this is a guy that gave us the shot at the Taj. This is a guy that was always hitting me up whenever good things happened, and this was the guy that I considered a friend. Why would I say no and turn? And the way that when he called me, this is exactly what he said. He said, listen, if you don't want to do this, I completely understand. But I would be honored if you would speak at the RNC for me. And I said, I'll be there, brother.
If he asks again?
I'll be there.
Absolutely. And the one thing about the former president, he wants to be the next president again. You know a fighter's heart. You stare in more fighters' eyes than anybody else to see what's in there. Where does he rank at 77?
Number one. Number one, take any of the greatest fighters of all time, Trump is number one. The most resilient human being that I have ever met in my life.
In what respect?
Why keep doing this? Yeah. You know, you got money, you got a great life, you got whatever. Why keep doing this? And the one thing that I can tell you, and this is a fact, this guy loves this country, right? And he loves all Americans, regardless of what color, religion, or whatever it is. He's not a racist, he's a good human being, and he loves America, and he cares about this country. Period. End of story. If he wasn't that type of guy, I would never even associate myself with him.
Right. And prediction? How's he going to do in 2024?
I don't know. This is, you know, looking good. You know, they're throwing the kitchen sink at this guy right now. And like I just said, the most resilient human being I've ever met. He just keeps marching forward.
You know, they keep saying that America's gone soft and the world's gone soft and everyone's the men are getting in touch with their sensitive side. There's a lot of adrenaline in your stands, in the octagon, in the people promoting it, the people on the stage. Are you the anomaly?
Probably. Yeah, I would agree that the world has gone soft, and I would agree that we are not in any way, shape, or form.
You also say, but if you are not and you're a savage with today's landscape, you can make it killing easier. If you get that mentality.
I literally just, every time, we have a great intern program at UFC, and all the interns met with me on Wednesday. And I always speak to them all when we come in, we do a Q&A. And I say this all the time. I mean, when I grew up, there was a lot of old money. You know what I mean? And if you didn't have old money, it was harder to make it. It was harder to There's a lot of disruption now. If you'd have told me 25 years ago taxi cabs would be gone, the cable industry would start getting busted up and everything was going to go global and streaming, the internet, the social media and all this stuff, there's never, ever been more opportunity in my lifetime than there is right here and right now. And if you are one of these young kids who has some heart and some grit and some determination and you want to win, there's never been more opportunity than there is right now.
So a 19-year-old Dana White had to go make a living. You had to be a bellhop. You had to be a paver. You had to have side jobs. Or else there's no safety net. For people that have a safety net, there's no urgency, or your kids that because of your success, they don't have to worry about what they're going to eat. How do you keep the hunger if you don't need to have that?
And different than hunger, I think I say this all the time. The big problem with a lot of people in life is they don't know what they want to do for the rest of their life. I was very lucky in that I always knew what I wanted to do. But
which was?
Be in the fight business. It wasn't this, was what but I wanted to be in the fight business, right? No matter what it was. And I started my way from the bottom and I worked my way up to the top. But these jobs like paving roads, being a bellman and all this stuff, these are the type of jobs you have to have growing up so you know what you don't want to do. You know what it's like to really work hard. Like, people tell me all the time, you work hard. I mean, I get to work every day at 9 and I leave at 9. Now, you know who works hard? The guys up at EJ Paving in Massachusetts who are paving roads every day and digging ditches, and guys that pour concrete, guys that are doing roofing jobs. That's hard work. So you have to have those type of jobs to understand what real hard work really is.
And also, you have taken this hard work and you said, okay, America, I like to shine here, but I also want to be a force around the world. What are you doing now with Abu Dhabi? What are you doing now in Saudi Arabia? What are you doing now to expand this global brand?
Well, the beautiful thing that I've always said since day one, I said this will eventually be the biggest sport in the world, because no matter what color you are, what country you come from, what language you speak, we're all humans. And fighting is in our DNA. We get it and we like it and it makes sense and everybody understands it. And when you find a guy who is the baddest dude or woman in the world and they come from where you come from and they speak like you speak and they look like you, everybody rallies around them.
Right.
So, you know, there isn't a fighter in the world, a country in the world that we can't find a fighter from. And like I told you, as it continues to expand with streaming and we go into these places that we've never been. We're going to go to Saudi Arabia for the first time. We're working on Africa. We haven't been to Spain yet. I just opened a performance institute down in Mexico City. Some of the baddest dudes to ever walk the face of the earth have been Mexicans. So imagine the Mexicans that are going to come out of this place in the next 5 to 10 years.
So you build a facility and the fighters will come?
100%. 100%. The one thing that we've done, when you think about this, think about a business that's ever existed in the history of the world that has produced trillions of dollars in revenue. Like
right.
Boxing has.
Right.
And at the end of the day, there's nothing there. We built a league. We reinvest in the sport and in the UFC every year. Millions and millions, tens of millions to hundreds of millions of dollars that we reinvest into the company and into the sport to, you know, sort of reach this vision that I have of being global.
Qatar hosts the World Cup. Fox goes over there. People say, why are you going over there? Saudi Arabia buys LIV and they're competing with golf. They might do the same thing with tennis. How do you feel about this?
Yeah, Saudi's making big moves. I mean, if you look at what they're doing with boxing right now, some of the biggest fights that would have never happened are happening because of Saudi Arabia. That's how crazy boxing has become. It takes Saudi Arabia money to make some of these fights. But, you know, it's
compete.
A good thing. Compete. Compete, man. You got to compete. It's what I always say. You know, people have called us a monopoly and all this stuff for years. Not a monopoly. We're just the best.
Right.
We're the best at what we do. There's no barrier to entry. Anybody could get into this. You could start a league tomorrow. And
good
you
luck.
Pay the guys whatever you want. And you can do whatever you want. But a lot of smart, talented, big business moguls have got into this sport and
right.
tried to compete with me. And they couldn't do it. But everybody... There's no barrier to entry. Anybody can get into this thing tomorrow. So, listen, you have to have that competitive spirit in you. You got to want to compete. And, you know, I ended up meeting with Sheikh Turki from Saudi Arabia, and we're doing things with him now. I've been really close to the royal family of Abu Dhabi for many, many years, and they've been instrumental in helping us build this business, not just, you know, in the Middle East, but all over the world. Fight Island, during COVID, happened in Abu Dhabi. I mean, they've been incredible partners to me.
Of course, it's always great hearing from Dana White. More on that in a moment. Just the other news, Hunter Biden found guilty in that gun case on all counts. He could face up to 25 years in prison, $750,000 in fines. Back with more Dana White. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Welcome back, everyone. Part two of my Dana White interview coming your way. Just a quick reminder, Indianapolis, Indiana. I'm going to be there coming up pretty quick, couple of weeks. June 29th, History, Liberty, and Laughs Tour. Shelton Auditorium. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. VIP tickets, meet and greet time right before. And on the 27th, Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. That's 27th of July. Now it's time for more of my interview with Dana White. And we talk about loyalty and this guy named Joe Rogan.
The one thing that sticks with me and when I think about you is loyalty. And I think about, too, the story I always wanted, how Joe Rogan went from the guy on Fear Factor to, even though he looked like an athlete the whole time, to the perfect announcer for you. I did not know he worked for you for free. I did not know you saw him on another show, and I think a VHS tape,
yep,
and say, I got to find that guy. Can you describe this, the genesis of this relationship?
So when we first bought the company was based in New York. So I had to fly from Vegas to the New York offices and go through and figure out what was going to come back to Vegas and what I was going to throw away. Well, they had a wall as big as this wall here full of tapes. So I had to go through every single tape. And one of the tapes that I popped in was the Keenan Ivory Wayans show. He had his talk show back then, and he had Joe Rogan on, the Fear Factor guy.
Big hit, by the way, right. Big syndicate show.
Yep. And he said, you like this Ultimate Fighting stuff too, right? And Rogan just goes into this, you know, talking about how incredible the sport is, what these guys would do to some of these movie stars that do martial arts and what they would do to boxers and all this stuff. And I saw him, and it just clicked, and I go, this is the guy I need. This is who I need to be my commentator. So I ended up reaching out to Rogan, and we hit it off, and that's it. He said, wait a minute, so you're telling me I can come to the sport that I love the most in the world, have the best seat in the house, and talk about it on TV? I'm in. He did the first 13 for free. And the rest is history. He's now the biggest podcaster in the world. And he's the greatest combat sports commentator of all time.
And it's all instinct, isn't it?
It's what?
It's instinct.
Yeah.
Like he knew that excitement is just roar. You also talked about broadcasts that bothered you. You know, when we were watching, I'm a big boxing guy. Lampley, Larry Merchant, whether it's Sugar Ray Leonard, George Foreman. You said that critical commentators were ruining these events for you. They didn't have enough respect for the fighters.
100%. All those guys were terrible. They were terrible. At that time, HBO boxing was the gold standard of the sport. But nothing had really changed except HD. You know what I mean? They put on a good event. They put money into it. But I would have to mute the commentators all the time.
Because you don't feel they spent enough respect for the fighters?
I'm not buying this event to listen to you idiots, okay, who think you know all this stuff about boxing and, you know... Larry Merchant jumping up and telling Floyd Mayweather if he was 30 years younger, he'd kick his ass. Yeah, no, you wouldn't. I mean, and the amount of disrespect to even think that you could, and the disrespect to say that, and Lampley and all those other guys, they were clowns to me. And I used them as what not to do when we they're buying this thing because of the athletes. They're buying those fights because of Mike Tyson, Evander Holyfield, you know, and all the other greats that fought. Not because of the commentators.
Right.
We don't want to hear their opinions.
Did you like Cosell? Did he help sell that sport at that time?
Well,
he was critical.
What's interesting is the relationship between Ali and Cosell, you could tell that Ali hated him in the early days, and they would go back and forth, but they ended up respecting and liking each other at the end. But there was no love between those two in the early days when they first started.
But in your head, fighting mentality, but you also had the sense of production.
Right.
Where'd that come from?
I don't know. My thing was is that I was such a fan, I felt like I knew what other fans. And we did a deal with HBO. I don't know if you know that.
No.
But we did a deal with HBO where we were going to put fights on HBO. HBO came in and started going, we're going to have to turn this music down. This is going to... I said, whoa. No. You guys are not running our production and telling us what to do.
How big were you at this time?
We had already signed the deal.
Okay.
We were done. So I literally called Lorenzo and said, yeah, we can't do this deal. He's like, what do you mean we can't do this deal? The deal's done. We have a deal. We got to get out of this deal. And Ari got us out of the HBO deal.
So, Ari Emanuel.
Yeah.
But were you worried about this, you blowing your chance? Like, HBO was the gold standard. Were you saying to yourself, this is a risk?
No, I believe that if we had let HBO do what they wanted to do, it would have hurt us and hurt our brand. And yeah.
And when you first
it would have made it stale and old and you know, like boxing was.
Because you had this vision, and the Fertitta brothers, you guys were friends before you were partners.
Yeah.
And that had a lot to do with it.
What do you mean as far as what?
You were, like, you guys had a trust for each other. Where you tell them, blow up this deal.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, and you know, I'll tell you another story. So CBS tried to come in and make us an offer to buy us at one point, right? And I was in Hawaii on vacation. And ironically, I'm usually late to everything. I was on the call early, and the Showtime guys were on the call early because I didn't know they were going to be on. I thought we were talking to Les Moonves. So by the time Les Moonves and Lorenzo got on the phone, me and Showtime were fighting, going at it. Literally, F you, back and forth. And those guys got on and heard us going back and forth, and the call, literally, that was the end of it. So Lorenzo calls me right back immediately and goes, I guess we're not doing a deal with CBS. I said, sorry. We got into it a little bit. I hated the guys at Showtime. A bunch of those guys worked for the UFC when we first started out. I thought their production sucked. I thought they were terrible at what they did, and I was very vocal about it. And then it just so happens we're talking about CBS making us a $1 billion offer to possibly buy the company. Okay. And by the time the Lorenzo and Les Moonves get on, full-blown war on the phone.
Right.
Yeah.
That is fantastic. I never heard that.
Never told it.
Okay. Well, I'm honored.
Wow. So there's a lot of breaking news and a lot of great insight. Dana White in the latest with the man that could be the 47th president of the United States and about his incredible career. And, of course, the breaking news about Hunter Biden being found guilty on all counts, facing up to 25 years in prison, $750,000 in fines. And now there's more talk of Hamas and a peace deal they might have agreed to. What an hour it's been. Hope you've enjoyed it. Next time you hear from me, I'll be in Texas, the studios of KLIF. Keep it here, the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.